Good morning. So last time we talked about some miscellaneous assembly topics, starting with specifying memory locations. We mentioned the sort of D word, word byte, when you need to specify a length, and the examples we had where we were like moving a constant to a valid address in memory without specifying a register, so we didn't know the length otherwise. We also talked about how the multiply and divide instructions work a little bit. We talked about LEA, which, as I said, at least in my experience, has been the instruction that most confuses students. And we started talking about the calling convention, which we mentioned were rules, so functions can call each other consistently and not like be confused about who's using what register, where the arguments are. So it's this agreement about what happens there. And we were in the middle of looking at sort of examples of what happens there. So any questions about any of these topics or anything I didn't list that we covered last time before I move on? So we'll go through some more examples of calling conventions. And we finished on this example last time, which is one way of implementing this function we're using as a running example, which just adds its three arguments together and returns them. And here we decided we're going to put the local variable in the stack, because that's where our temporary storage is. It's the most straightforward thing to do, and we just access the arguments directly. So the calling convention doesn't prescribe that you have to do that. It prescribes that, well, your stack doesn't change when you return. It's where you started. And prescribes that you put the return value in RAX, but it doesn't actually say like how you write the function. So we have other ways we could have written the function. So we could have decided, hey, A, B, C, and result, those are our local variables. And well, using the stack is kind of awkward. I can't use two memory locations in an instruction. So I'd really like to have my things in registers. So I'm going to try to put my local variables in registers. They're also faster, it happens. And so I'm just going to allocate a register for every local variable. So here, you know, whoever wrote this decided, okay, I'm going to use R8 for A, R9 for B, then C for RBX, and R12 for result. They just decided, you know, I don't want to use the argument registers first. I want to allocate other registers that we're not using in some order. And that's a valid thing to do. It, you know, doesn't violate the calling convention. So R8 and R9, those are not callee saved. Those are registers that the caller needs to assume that we're changing. So even if the caller is calling this version, they can't assume that we're not changing it because all they know are the rules in the calling convention. So we could just replace it with this and it better work, or else whoever called this function was using it wrong. And for registers like RBX and R12, we can absolutely use them if we want to. We just need to follow the rule that we save their old values, for example, by pushing them on the stack, and then restore them later. So this is, you know, a reasonable policy that you could implement, and you know, it would just work out perfectly well. So we start, we save RBX, so we have some old value in RBX that the caller of our function might expect to be preserved. We don't actually know for sure that the caller is using RBX, but we have to assume just in case, because we don't know exactly how the function calling us is written, just like the function calling us doesn't know exactly how we are written. Similarly, we save R12, and then we do this bunch of moves to copy our local variables, which we decided that we are going to put A, B, C, and result to set those variables. Straightforward, you know, first copying from the arguments into our, this is what we decided were local variables. Then we do our additions into result. Then we have to return result. And remember, returning a value means just put in RAX and make sure it stays there until you return. Because when, after we return, the function that called us is going to look in RAX to find its return value, the return value it was looking for. So we move the result into RAX, and then we undo our saving of registers because we need R12 and RBX to be back to their old values. So in this case, hex 5, 6, 7, 8, and hex 1, 2, 3, 4, which maybe our calling function was using, maybe it wasn't, but we have to restore them just in case. And after we pop those off the stack, our stack pointer pointed at our return address, so we run our return instruction, it takes that return address and starts executing the code there. So this example makes sense. So this is another way of writing the same function we started with. So previously, we decided I'm going to put result on the stack, and I'm going to access all my arguments only directly. Here we decided I'm going to have a different policy. I'm going to have this list of registers that I just chose arbitrarily, where I'm going to put local variables. And when those local variables happen to be the names of parameters, I'm just going to copy them at the beginning to initialize them. These are both completely valid ways of implementing this function, because they all obey the calling convention. As long as our caller follows the rules they're supposed to, both of these will work with anyone calling our function. And as far as they're concerned, it's the same function. It maybe just has slightly different performance, and so on.
Do we have to push R10 and R11 if we use them in the function?
So the question is, do you have to push R10 and R11 if you use them in the function? So this is, I don't actually memorize the registers, so. Where is the list? It's here. There we are. So R10 and R11 are on this list of caller saved registers. So you can have to assume, as someone calling functions, that every function call changes R10 and R11. And that means if you're writing a function that doesn't call other functions, you never need to save them. And I know I'm using the word save and not push, because you have other options for saving registers. Like if you want to copy it to another register and copy it back, I calling your function can't tell you did that. Okay, so we saw these multiple options for implementing this function. So you might ask, first of all, these both seem pretty silly. Like, we're doing some things which aren't great. Like, why are we allocating space in the stack? That took two extra instructions, one to allocate it, one to deallocate it, and we had to write keyword pointer. Why don't we use a register for that? Why don't we use, in fact, REX? Because we need to use that for the return value anyways. Couldn't we do this better? So you might ask, what are compilers going to do? And compilers really do have a variety of things they do, but they just make sure they always follow these calling convention rules. But they actually, there's a variety of things you can get compilers to do, depending on what compiler you're using and what options you provide the compiler. They all obey this calling convention, but there's all these options for how you implement the function. So let's look at the output of Clang with a certain set of options that I carefully chose to make it kind of straightforward. So here's some real output from Clang with some slight reformatting. So does this seem like a good implementation of this function? I'll give you some time to read it since it is surprisingly long. Yeah. Why not? Why do you not think this is a...
So much work. Like, why do we need result, right? Why are we starting something at zero if we're going to,
okay.
Equals zero. Okay, right? Why do we need to store RDX into result in order to add it to B? Can't we just do add B RDX, right?
Okay, yeah. So there's a lot of extra work going on here. And most of that work is putting something on the stack and taking it off the stack. So this is really the code that Clang generates without optimizations. This is almost what you'll get if you run without any flags. I actually added a flag, so Clang will allocate stack space. It by default uses RSP minus values instead of RSP plus. which we haven't talked about when that's okay to do or not, which is why I didn't show it. But this is really what claim generates when you don't turn on what are called optimization flags. So we have this stack layout. We have value of A, B, C, and results. They're all in the stack. And we do these crazy things where we like store A on the stack from a register, then copy A into a temporary register because we can't add two values on the stack together directly, then use that temporary register to add the value, and so on. Like, really inefficient. So does anyone have a theory for why would Clang generate code like this? Why would they have this as a sort of code they generate? What about this inefficient stuff Clang is doing makes it desirable for the compiler writer to implement it? Yeah. So the question is it simple or intuitive? So it's probably not intuitive, but it is simple. And it's simple in a very peculiar sense, which is that it always works. Like, if you want to use a local variable, it always works to put it on the stack. Putting it in a register doesn't always work, right? You might run out of registers. If you want to add two values together, it always works to load the value from wherever it is into a temporary register and then add it directly to the other value. So these are code sequences which always works no matter whether you run out of registers or not. And that's why Clang has this code to generate it. And that's why it's a sort of default no optimizations code looks like this. And this is true of most compilers, that they use these coding sequences where they do a lot of what looks like extra work because they're doing something which always works no matter how many local variables you have, no matter how many registers you have to deal with. So it's simple in that sense. For humans, this code is not intuitive because it is doing all this, like, why, you know, you would say, why am I copying a value to the stack, then back to a register, then back to the stack, then back to a register, you know. But as far as writing the compiler, it's easy to say, this value lives on the stack, I can always allocate more stack space so I never run out, and I just copy it to a register just to do one operation and then back. And that's the code they generate. That makes it easy to write the compiler. And typically compilers have what they call optimizations, which are designed to make the code fast or efficient. And it's when you do these optimizations that they take the code that's this inefficient and they analyze it to figure out, oh, wait, I'm doing this thing where I copy a value from the stack to a register and back to the stack. I can just put that in a register instead. So that's when they do this analysis. So, since we've seen the inefficient Clang version, what do you think an efficient version of this function would look like? So, and remind you, there's the code of the function. What would an efficient, what would you write? What would that look like if you wrote this? Do you have to include result equals zero? So that's a question. So the answer is, how can your caller know if you did? They can't. You don't have to include it. And I can't see a way they would know. And that's the general rule compilers are optimizing things. They'll do all sorts of tricks. As long as you calling the function can't notice, it's fine. Yeah.
All right, so A comes in the register, right? Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay.
So you're going to do add move.
Just add because I'm going to use the argument register A came in on.
Okay. So you add so add A to B into A, add C to the A register, and then you need to return it.
So move it to RAX.
And move it to RAX. Yeah. So that sort of pattern is fairly straightforward, and this is probably what I would write by hand, something like this. I wrote it in a slightly different way. I set RAX to zero, which is slightly less efficient. So you're like even taking the shortcut of doing like move, which is a little better, basically. But something like this, we do two adds and a move, because that's the work we need to do. And you know, you say, this is what I write by hand. And you might say, well, that's probably Clang generates something that kind of looks like this if you turn on optimizations, and that's kind of right. Clang, in fact, is more clever than this. This is what Clang generates with optimizations. Clang saves an extra instruction. Because Clang knows about LEA, which I'm sure you all forgot about from last time. And LEA lets you add two things together, do the add two values, and move it to REX in one instruction. And for this sort of reason, if you need to look at assembly code generated by compilers, you should have a strong preference to looking at the optimized code. Because yes, this does some weird stuff, but gosh, it would take a lot less time to figure out than this. Especially if you got the version that you would get from the compiler, which won't have all those comments. Yeah.
How would the debugging flags and things like that affect the...
So the question is, how do debugging flags change the code? So, so most current compilers allow you to combine optimization and debugging flags. This wasn't always true. So given that, debugging flags then just affect information that's typically on the side. So there's usually like a list of, for each function, where are the local variables? For each function, where do I find the return value so I can go to the function that's calling it? So there's this extra information that's usually on the side of the assembly code. So you'll have the assembly function as usual, and you'll have some extra stuff in the assembly file, which is that information for the debugger. That's usually what happens. So sometimes you might try to make changes to the actual code you generate to help the debugger out. For example, some optimizations can change code in ways that it's hard to explain to debuggers. And it used to be the case, like 10, 15 years ago, that most debuggers were actually really, really bad at dealing with optimized code. Now they're only kind of bad. But it used to be the case that, like, if you optimized your code, like, your debugger couldn't consistently get a stack trace. So that's my sort of summary of calling convention issues. So remember, so you're writing a called function. So the things we do is you save any of the registers the function uses, you allocate your stack space. This is sort of the normal pattern. Note that not these steps aren't prescribed in this order by the calling convention. The calling convention just cares what can I calling your function notice. So like if you allocate stack space and then save things, that's fine as long as I can't notice you did that in the quote unquote wrong order. Then you do the actual function body, you place your return address, return value in REX. And you deallocate your stack space and restore any save registers. You do the opposite of your steps to get things back to the way the caller expects. And a key thing to remember about the calling convention is rules so we can safely call functions and not be surprised about like what happens to our registers. And so we know a systematic way of writing functions. So this is a systematic thing you can do. By their calling convention, but it's just about what effects can we notice, which means, yeah, you can do weird things, like you can save in the wrong order, you know, you can copy values to registers first and then save them. You can save values by copying them into a register that you're allowed to use, like probably you wouldn't, but all that is valid. You can do these weird things. And that doesn't say you're not complying to the calling convention. If you want to say, this function doesn't comply with the calling convention, the way you should prove that is by saying, I could write this function that calls it, that obeys all the rules, and it would have something weird happen. So for example, if you don't restore your stack pointer, that violates the calling convention. And a way you can prove that is you can write a function which allocates some stack space, calls a function, and expects to access that stack space, and it will get the wrong answer, right? That's how you can know that function, which doesn't restore the stack pointer back where it started, violates the calling convention. It breaks these functions, which are doing everything they're supposed to do. So any questions about calling convention issues? Okay, so one piece of terminology for the calling convention related things. We have all these things that we push onto the stack for a function. So we have the registers we save, we have our local variables, if we're at, or any other temporary storage, we have a return address, we have, you know, things that were saved to call us. So these are all called an activation record. And when you think of a stack trace in a debugger, it's really a list of activation records. It's really what you can think of it as being. So you can think of our stack is actually a stack of these activation records, and within each activation record, we have the individual items that were pushed onto the stack, like return addresses and space for local variables and so on. And we have a few missing calling convention pieces that we didn't talk about, most of which we won't talk about, some of which we might have you do for the lab. So one is, I never talked about floating point. Floating point is handled differently. There's actually a set of registers for floating point that we didn't show you, and that's typically what's used in the calling convention for when you have floating point arguments and return values. Not all arguments and return values fit in a register. So for arguments, they're passed on the stack instead, like we saw with excess arguments. But even if they're like the first argument, you have to put them on the stack. With the return value, the rule is the caller allocates some space and passes a pointer as an argument, essentially. And we also didn't talk about how classes work. The simplest rule is that there's an implicit this argument. So that when you have a method for a class, there's an argument that you don't write in C++, which is the first argument, which is the this pointer. It's implicitly passed. And there's also a whole bunch of extra stuff going on for inheritance and some other things we might get to later. So if you want to know the completely authoritative thing about the calling convention, and this is linked from the slides page, this is, for Linux, the reference manual. So it is a reference manual, and section 3.2 covers the calling convention. The rest of this manual covers things like what format are executables in, what format are object files in, how does exception unwinding work, exception like returning to another function work. And section 3.2 covers the calling convention. It is complete and hard to read. But it is complete, it covers all the corner cases, like what if we were passing a struct that fits in a register, like do we put in a register or not, covers all those cases in exacting detail. And therefore it's a little hard to read, but it covers everything without exception. So this is for C. And on Linux, the way the C++ calling convention works is that there's this document called the Itanium C++ ABI, which sounds weird. Because why are we talking about an Itanium thing, which is another CPU architecture? Well, the Itanium C++ ABI is actually platform neutral rules for converting basically C++ calls to C calls. And that's what's used on Linux to implement C++ stuff, is they have these rules to convert them to the C calling convention, and then they use the C calling convention. And this specifies, most importantly, like how classes are laid out and all that. So this is the authoritative document for that. Like with the calling convention document, it covers all the corner cases. So it has all these features of C++ you've never seen and probably will never use. And it mentions how do you make those all work the same between compilers. But it always has the answer. It's just hard to read. So that's actually everything I have on the calling convention. So just pointing these out because you may or may not want to refer to them for the homework, and I feel I'd be remiss in not telling you that like there is actually a written document which says what it is in all cases. Okay, so let's talk about some missing assembly instructions. So one is AND, OR, and XOR. And you might think, well, and an or, that must act like the and or, and this is not and and not or. And the reason is that it works bit by bit. So it takes, for example, two registers, and it takes each bit of the register. So and says one ended with zero is zero, one ended with one is one, one ended with zero is zero, zero ended with one is zero. Like it does each pair of bits, and that's how it selects the result. So it's not like the and or operator in Python or the and or operator. In C and C++, this is exposed as the and or an XOR single character operators, which you probably haven't used much. And I mention these because you'll often see this in compiler-generated code, because compilers, like, if they find a way to do math with these, they often will. These are easy for the hardware implement, so they're pretty fast instructions. So any questions about these? Okay. So I would like to talk a bit about stuff we missed when we talked about conditional jumps. So our sort of notion is that you have a comp, and you have a jump, and that's how jumps work. That's how conditional jumps work. You have a, you know, like a j greater than equal. And this is certainly all you need to know for writing assembly code, but if you read compiler generated code, you'll often see, you know, some stuff and then a JGE, and you'll look here, where's a comp, and you won't find it. You know, so what's going on? And you might say, you know, you might remember, oh, comp sent some flags that might not have to be used right away, but you won't find any relevant comp. And there's other things which set the flags used by the conditional jump instructions besides comp. So comp is the most common, and certainly if you're writing assembly by hand, the easiest to use to do everything you want, but it's not the only thing that does it. So the most notable thing is that most arithmetic instructions set the flags. So fraction, so most of the arithmetic instructions set the flags. And they set the flags basically like they're comparing the result to zero. And this is true of all the arithmetic instructions. So I'm missing some corner cases, like you might say, what about overflow, things like that. But as a first approximation, it's basically comparing the result to zero. And compilers will often take advantage of this. Most frequently, they'll do something like this. Well, they'll have a subtract or a deck, which also sets the flags, and they'll use that to loop until something goes to zero. They'll often like restructure loop indexes to make this possible because it saves an instruction. You got rid of a compare instruction. Yay, that should be faster. And compilers will do lots of crazy things to make this happen if you turn on optimizations. So when you're reading assembly code generated by compilers, you might see this sort of pattern where they subtract something and that sets the flags, so now we can do J and E to say if it's not equal to zero, go back to the beginning. And the flags are set as if you did a compare to zero of the result. And this is true for, as I said, most arithmetic instructions. So any questions about what happens here? Yeah.
So like if you want to compare to the value like other than zero, then we have to indicate like compare like rex comma value we want to compare to, right?
Yeah, so if you want to, so you can't use this trick if comparing to zero isn't what you want to do. So typically what you'll see compilers do is they'll like change a loop that goes from zero to n to go to n to zero to make this happen. But if you don't do that, you're going to write an explicit compare instruction and not compare it to zero. And compilers will do that when they don't change the loop like that. Okay. So this is one notable set of instructions beside the flag. So basically all the arithmetic and the subtract case is by far the most common in compiler generated code, just to save that one compare instruction. The other notable case is there's an instruction called test, which only sets the flags like comp, but it works differently. So test with the same register twice is basically the same as comparing to zero. It's not quite the same. Like it doesn't handle, like it doesn't assume, handle, you know, less than or greater than the same way, but probably if you're comparing to zero, that's not what you can't quite care about. It's most directly equivalent to anding a value with itself. It basically does that. If you're comparing the same values, test does an and discards the result, but compares that result to zero to set the flags. But almost all the time you'll see it used where we test register and the same register. And usually this is just being used to say, is this register positive, negative, or zero? Rather than comparing to zero. And it happens to be a shorter instruction and a slightly faster instruction, because just testing something compared to zero directly rather than an arbitrary value, which is what the comp instruction does, is a little faster. So compilers will often generate it. So questions about test? Okay. Okay, so those are, I think, all the instructions I'm going to explicitly talk about as instructions. So I've talked about sort of the micro layout of programs here, and let's go through the big picture. So we mentioned activation records, and probably I should give some context for like where is the stack relative to other things. What about other memory we use? So this is, on Linux, the typical layout of a program. It's not guaranteed to look like this. But the typical layout is we have some approximately fixed location, not necessarily, where our code starts. And then we have our global writable data after that. So like global variables, static members of classes, and so on. And then we have what we call our heap, where things like new memory goes. And we have the stack. And traditionally, these two things grow towards each other. So the idea is that you can keep allocating stack space until you hit the heap. That's sort of the conceptual idea. It's not actually how it works, because there's usually some invalid memory in between. The operating system sets that up deliberately so you don't accidentally overwrite your heap. And this is sort of how things grow. And so this means when you see addresses that are really, really high, that's probably the stack. When you see them that are lower, that's probably the heap and things like that. So questions about this memory layout? Yeah?
Does the OS ever allow us to access that stuff?
The used by operating system part? So that is stuff that generally, if you try to access it, it won't work. Okay. You'll get a segfault. But yeah, it's part of your, it's addresses which are used by the OS, even though you can't in your program access them like addresses. Presume in future courses, you might learn why the OS would want to do that. Other questions? Yeah.
What do you mean by writable data?
So writable data, this is, so this is global variables. Static class members, etc. So this is data which can change in our program, but starts out allocated. So the key distinction here, so this is allocated when the program starts. whereas the stuff I have in the heap isn't allocated when the program starts, right? All the stuff you make with new, your main function has to start doing things before that exists. The stuff that I listed as writable data is stuff which has an initial value that's loaded with your program. Right. Another way of looking at it is you can look at the executable and quickly find out exactly how much writable data there is for the heap. You have to like figure out how is new being called. Okay, so as you're probably aware, we're having you do some assignments which involve looking at assembly. So I'd like to talk about one tool that I find extremely useful for this. And that's godbolt.org, which is a compiler explorer, which someone wrote and is really handy compared to the manual way. So this is what it looks like. We're going to play the game with that. So you can enter some, say, C++ code, and you can add these things for different compilers. So here I have Clang version 6. Newer than the version we have on our lab machines, GCC version 7.3, and ICC, that's Intel C compiler, version 18, and I'm passing OFAST, O2, and -O. These are flags to enable optimizations, and you can see three different versions of that sum function I showed you earlier. And godbolt.org has done the work of figuring out how to find the assembly code from within the giant output files of the compiler. So for example, if I disable the various features here that don't hide the incredible amount of stuff that the compiler generates in addition, this output becomes a little less readable. That's what those flags do, is that they just strip out a whole bunch of extra information in the file, like there's some debugging information here. As I mentioned, the debuggers have these side tables. This is like the string A, so the debugger knows there's a variable A. Like that's all in this file. And we also have, I guess, isn't that? Yeah. So, and we have, oh right, isn't there? And we have some labels in the function like lfunc_n0, which aren't used, which this knows how to strip out. But when you look at compiler generated code directly, you'll have to deal with that yourself, probably. And we'll talk a little bit about what some of that is. And it also does what we'll call demangling. So when we don't have this demangle option on, you'll see that the name of the function is _Z3SumLLL. And yes, that is the actual name in assembly, and it translates to this, which this tool will do for you. I will talk about that in a bit. So I'd like to mention this because it's handy for the assignment. Also, it's like, I find it the most convenient way for looking at what do compilers do, what is my compiler probably doing, or what compilers do to this code, which I've needed to discover more times than I thought I would. Yeah?
Can we also use this as a decompiler?
Can you use this as a decompiler? The answer is not, probably not, because its input is C, or C++, or some other programming language that there's a list of supported ones. So, other questions? Okay. Okay, so that's sort of the worked out solution, but sometimes you'll have a file and you'll want to do this by hand. So with Clang, you can add the -S option to get the assembly output, which is the same assembly output that tool is using. If you just add -s, this is going to be an AT&T assembly syntax. So the other assembly syntax, not the one you're used to. So, like, you probably don't want to do that. we have this option, which is in the lab write-up, which you can pass, this series of options. So these two flags are a pair, and then minus S. But those two, that minus MLVM and the minus minus XD6 ASM minus equals Intel, need to be together, not in the in that order next to each other. Those say, don't output an AT&T syntax, use Intel-like syntax. So this is much closer to the syntax we'll be using, but it's still not quite the same as what NASM expects. Mostly there's differences in the directives that are accepted. So for example, the directives in this assembly syntax, assembly output, will have dots in front of them where NASM will expect no dot. So let's go through an example. So here we have an example C++ file. You note that I've done extern C here, and seen that in some of the examples that we provide. This says, I want you to make this look like a C function for callers. I want you to have this be called like a C function, not a C++ function. And the most notable thing that does is it turns off that what name mangling you saw earlier, where our sum function was actually named underscore Z, capital Z3, it turns that off, because in C, we don't do that. We'll talk about why in a bit. So if you look at the output file in AT&T syntax, you'll find that there's an absolute value function in the middle of it. There's also a whole lot of other output that I'm not showing you. And this is AT&T syntax. If in the future you need to read AT&T syntax, here's my one slide, like how to translate to Intel syntax rules. The biggest thing, the most confusing thing if you're trying to read it, is that it's destination last, which is not what you expect. The other big thing is that there's this syntax, so this displacement-based index scale is shorthand for that. You know, memory at that location. Those are the biggest things that make it hard to read coming from Intel syntax. Okay. So if we actually turn this into, you know, our normal thing, we get this into our Intel syntax, we get this code. Note that Clang doesn't bother allocating stack space. It just, direct by subtracting from the RSP, it just directly uses it. The rule in the calling convention, I guess I should mention it just to dissuade you from doing it. The rule in the calling convention for doing that is that you can use, I believe it's 128 bytes of space below the stack pointer. And if you use more than that, you might set fault. It's something like 128. It's some number of bytes. If you use more than that, you segfault. So to be safe, I'd recommend always subtracting from the stack pointer. But our compiler knows what the rule is and takes advantage of it. And this is the unoptimized code. So we're computing absolute value by copying RDI, then comparing it to zero instead of comparing RDI to zero, and then copying that value back to RCX, subtracting that value from RCX, and then, you know, that silly stuff where we're copying values back and forth, because this is unoptimized code. And you'll note that we're using keyword pointer here, because we're accessing, because we have wrote the function, if we look back here, with long. So if we replace our longs with ints, we get the same code essentially with dword pointer and with the 32-bit registers instead of the 64-bit ones. So any questions about this generated code? Okay. So as I mentioned earlier, generally, I would prefer to look at the optimized code, because this code is doing some silly things, like it's not a good way of writing it, and it's also hard to read because there's these extra steps like copying and then copying back somewhere. So let's look at the optimized code. So here's the optimized code. It has this weird instruction, cmovel. So if you look up cmovel, CMoveOut is move if less than. So it's like a jump less than, but instead of going somewhere, it doesn't move if the condition is true, and then just keeps going. So negate sets the flags because it's an arithmetic instruction. That's what neg is, the negate, you know, times minus one instruction. And then if it's less than zero, yeah, we move RDI into REX. So we, you know, negate REX. If we get a negative value, we move the original value into REX, and then we return. So this is probably not what you would have written. This is another case of our compiler knows a little bit more about the instruction set than you do, which makes sense because they had a lot of time to write all the rules down in the compiler. You'd probably write something more like this. You know, or if you didn't know about negate, you would write something like this, where you subtract from zero instead of using the negate instruction. But they're all valid. So any questions about this absolute value code? Okay. So in our last three-ish minutes, I'd like to talk about other stuff that's in that .s file. So I only showed you this little portion of the .s file where you like search for absolute underscore value, and you found that, and that's what you got. So there's some other stuff. So there's some information at the top of the file saying, oh, this is the code part, .txt. This is Intel syntax. This is from the C++ file. This is, you know, helpful information. When you see the actual beginning of the code, you'll have all these funny things. So we have, like here, we have, this is some section text startup. We have this thing called CXX global var init. This is a function to init global variables. We have various mangled names. So because we can't use colons in our names, so our compiler writes them differently. So in this case, this underscore io init is standard something called underscore underscore io init, which is part of the cout implementation. And we have this constructor being named here, which is being called, which is again part of the cout implementation. We also have this underscore CFI stuff. This is stuff to implement the debugger and exceptions. This is annotations to help out the debugger and to help out implementing exceptions. When we get to our actual function, so we have some of those annotations to help out with the debugger. We have .global, which is like global in an ASM, which says make this label accessible in other files. If you don't do that, all the labels in the file aren't callable from elsewhere. And .type is just to help the debugger out. You know, it's not mandatory, but it makes the debugger understand what's going on. And if you look elsewhere, you'll see more of these funny, long, mangled names. So like, for example, that's what the call to the operator, insertion operator looks like. It just turns out to have that long name when you turn it into the, when you follow the rules for how do we name this in assembly. And I guess I'd like to finish up talking about that. So we mentioned that extern C changes the name to that label. So if we didn't do that, it looks like this. So this is the difference of extern C. So we saw examples of those mangled names when we had like operator colon colon. So there's all these rules for doing that. And the reason we do it for even this simple case, like it makes sense for classes, right? I need to have colons. I can't put colons in labels. So I need to do something. But why are we doing it in this case? The main reason is to allow different arguments. So in C, you can't have two functions with different arguments with the same name. In C++, that's allowed. And the way it's allowed by translating to assembly is you change the name in assembly based on the arguments. So these two functions have different names in assembly, and that's why when we call, we know which one we're calling. And I guess before I finish up, I'll mention just briefly one thing. If you ever need to demingle names in assembly, there's a program called C++ FILT, which does it. It will write out the name of any mangled C++ symbol name as something actually readable.